Welcome back to the A to Z Running Podcast, where we help runners thrive. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach, and up next, listener Q&A about bottles versus gels, social running, and fixing running mechanics. And after that, World of Running updates about Last Chance Track, a DeWalter record, and more. All right, this is A to Z Running, which means we're answering your questions, because that's like the core essence of the best things that we do is interact with runners. So we've got some real exciting and fun things to share in response to some very interesting questions. Mm-hmm. I always like to see what will people ask, because it's not always the same thing all the time. And So you keep us on our toes and we like it. Keep doing it. As a matter of fact, you should and will keep doing it, because you're going to go to azrunning.com/question right now. Well, probably not, because you're probably running right now. But you'll do that soon to ask even more questions. And I should note, one of the things that would potentially be even more valuable to you as you think about what questions are on your mind is when we answer a question and it tends to bring about more questions, because you're thinking, well, that's a fascinating thought, but then here's my situation, not exactly the same as someone else's. So how would you answer it in that situation? Ask away.
Sure.
It's lots of fun. And even if we don't put them on air, because, you know, we only have so many questions we can answer on air, we'll still respond to you and share thoughts in an email or wherever you ask them. So that's good.
Yeah. Even if we're a little delayed in our email response
Well,
time.
It's true. Because as you might guess, and as we absolutely should, we prioritize interactions with our athletes who pay us to coach them over other emails. And so if we don't have time to get to them right away, we'll share responses.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we met a listener in real life, as we love to do, at Johnny's Run 5K that was in Ada, Michigan. And Katie had shared with us that the series about the periodization in running, the different periods of training, was really helpful to her. And I was really encouraged to hear her say how much understanding training has helped her as she's thinking about her own goals and her own plans. So thank you, Katie, for coming up to us and for sharing those encouraging words.
True that. And also, as Katie noted, sometimes you're listening to us talk about things on the podcast, like some of the things we're going to talk about, in fact, today, and you think, I've got a friend who could really benefit from hearing those thoughts on that topic. It's not a bad idea to share that episode with that friend, but maybe in a way that doesn't sound like you really need this. Because sometimes
that feels... Because we all really need this, right?
Well, it's true. Everyone needs to hear what we have to say.
No, even if we understand things about running and training, it is still really good to be able to have these dialogues and to think about it more thoroughly, because I can only speak from my own experience, but sometimes my goals and running can become something I'm really attached to and don't have the greatest objective vision for my own training, even though I understand it. So being able to have these conversations, and then, you know, coaches have coaches. Zach has a coach, Barry McGee. I have a coach, which is Zach. You know, so all of this is because we want to be able to thrive as runners, and having great quality conversations about training and the science of running, and then having great guests on our podcast, like last week we had Fernando Cabada on our podcast to talk about his experience. All of it aids into helping us become better runners and to enjoy the sport more.
It's true. And added to the fact that, you know, that if A to Z Running says it, that it's gold.
Oh, goodness gracious.
So how can we ever go wrong? All right. Well, anyway, there's plenty of ways we can go wrong. We just pretend that we didn't, and then you believe us. Right?
Zach.
No? Oh, I'm still not getting there.
No.
This is why
no.
we need Andy, so that Zach doesn't keep stuffing his foot
rails.
In his mouth.
He's off the rails.
Well, by the way, we've got a lot to say that is, in fact, going to be fun to talk about. So we should probably just go ahead and get started with your questions.
It's listener Q&A time. Let's get started with a question from Sam.
Am I going to read it?
Go ahead.
Is that why you looked at me? Okay. All right. So Sam sent us this question, and I find it to be, well, I shouldn't contextualize. You should just hear it, and then you can find out why. I find this to be just a really fun question to talk about. Okay. Why do most pros fuel with bottles? Sam writes, He's talking about bottles filled with something liquid. During a marathon, while amateurs use gels, should we be trying to fuel with bottles instead? I could use or see, rather, this being difficult logistically in major marathons, but are bottles better? And if that's the case, what's the secret sauce in those bottles typically? That's fun. Well, thanks for the question, Sam. I find this to be really interesting because on a few layers. One, it's a question about what's actually happening with the bottles and what like the elites are doing in races and things like that. It's also a question about what should I be doing, which depending on what's happening may or may not answer the question differently too. So let's talk about this in layers because the first notice here, an assumption that the pros are using liquids in bottles and the amateurs are using gels. But the pros are just as often using gels as well. Is the first thing to note. They have them taped to the bottles. And so they'll grab the bottle and then they'll rip a gel off of it and do something. So they're using the same things you are, is the first thing that we should say. And that's going to be true 99% of the time. Every once in a while, the pros have some kind of weird cocktail that's, you know, like the next thing that's coming out by Genucan or something. You know, that's possible, but it's all the same stuff. So it's less a question of, what are they doing that no one else is doing? And more a question of why do they do things the way they do? And are there lessons we could take from that? Which is the other part of Sam's question. So I appreciate that. Because you're right, logistically, this would be challenging. So one thing to note is it's not a hard thing to do when the race says you can have a bottle on a table every 3 miles and you can put whatever you want in the bottle. Of course, they test that. So, you know, the elites aren't getting away with murder in their bottles, or what's the getting away with stealing the thing. Anyway, there's some kind of good idiom here, but so they have the opportunity and most of us don't. And so that's the first question. If I had the opportunity to have a bottle with whatever I wanted every 3 miles in a race, I would definitely use it. And I would do things differently than if I had to carry anything I wanted with me or just take whatever's on the race course, right? So that's something to think about. If you had that option, what would you do differently? And the first answer to that question is you'd probably have a more dynamic cocktail of fueling sources than just the standard gels on the course. Because for most of us, the standard gels in the course are not the best thing for us. I hear this almost every time I talk with a runner about the race plan fueling, nutrition plan. And, well, they have Martins at this race, but I don't really like Martins, or that doesn't really sit well with me, or that's not the one that I train with normally, you know, that kind of thing. We hear it all the time, right? So that's the first thing. If you wanted to try to pursue this angle, then you have to think about options that involve carrying my own bottles with me. But keep in mind that I could just as easily carry things like gels with me and just take the cups on the course, and I'm getting about the same experience as the elites with the bottles. So that brings up kind of the second thing that might be happening here, which is delivery method. So many, not all, but many do actually mix their gels into the bottle with other things.
That's what Zach does.
That's what we say when we say there's a cocktail of something there. They're mixing together an electrolyte mix with a gel, with water, or something like that. That's what I do. As a matter of fact, the things that I mix together shouldn't be mixed together. They
taste
horrible.
Awful. I tried it because I'm like, all right, I'm going to try what you do, Zach, and it tasted so bad.
So I have this really clever strategy that I employ that is just one of my many ways to get into people's heads. So when you're running at these kinds of races where they have like the bottles on the tables and stuff, one of the things you'll notice a lot of times is that the elites will actually like share their bottles with each other. It's a gesture of courtesy. Like, you know, we're in this thing together until I try to beat you. And so they'll like offer the bottle to the person next to them. And most of the time they, you know, decline because they've got their own, or they'll like take a very short sip, you know, because it's like, hey, we're in this thing together. It kind of feels cool to like share the, I don't know exactly what you're sharing, but yeah, germs. Well, anyway, so I do that. But remember what my cocktail in my bottle says, awful. It's nasty. And I do it because I know if they drink some, it's going to totally throw them off.
That's
like
mean.
Get in their head.
Come on,
like that
Zach.
Is disgusting. Now I've got this terrible taste in my mouth. And then also, what is this guy drinking next to me? Is this even legal? Now I don't know what's going on. So I do that and it's fun.
Okay.
I'm kidding, Andy. I mean, I kind of do that. And I think it is funny when people actually drink something from my bottle and realize how nasty it is. But usually it's just a good fun joke between us. Okay. So here's the kind of the straightforward reflection. The bottles are only something the elites do because it's an opportunity offered to them. It's not something that's like they request it or they specifically they have to have it or something like that. And so it's going to be, if you're a pro level marathoner, you will have that option every time you race, because they only ever race at events that do have those types of options. And that's one of the kind of the signature elements of, like, if you're sanctioning an event, for instance, to be a records legal course and all that type of stuff, that's one of the stipulations. You have to offer something like that. So in any event, because it's there, they take advantage of it. But in reality, what they're doing is no different than what anybody else is doing. They just might have their own preferred combination of things, and they can kind of refine that to a science in many ways. So they know, like, I want this many calories, and since I get a bottle every 3 miles, I know exactly how much to consume. Like, to the ounce, they'll even measure it. They'll put, like, they'll draw a line on their bottle, and they know they have to drink it down to that line each time. Like, things like that. They'll get very precise. But at the same time, most of that is an over scientizing, I'm not sure what the word is here, of the experience.
Because
it's not, well, yeah.
More or less, depending on the day and
the
weather.
It's not that, yes.
But I have to say, there are, like Zach said, maybe some takeaways. One thing is that it is easier to drink from a bottle than it is to drink from the little cups.
Way easier.
I know a lot of people don't like to carry things with them, but I do recommend carrying a bottle during a marathon, especially if it's a warmer marathon, to have control and to be able to drink more from your bottle. It is so much easier to consume the proper amount, and you get the electrolytes in it, so you're drinking the electrolytes rather than having just water or Gatorade options. Like, you're, like Zach said, able to fine tune it a little bit more. And then if you're able to part with that $7 bottle and throw it because you don't want to carry it anymore, and then take the liquids on the course the rest of the way, at least you're getting that in the early stages. I really do think that it's worth, like, you're spending how much money to do this marathon to pay for a little bottle that you might throw. I think it's worth it.
I mean, you're not gonna bring like a $50 bottle with you. So this is what I do. Every once in a while I have the great pleasure of being able to run an event that will offer bottles, and I can take advantage of that on tables, but most of the time I don't. However, I do, in all instances, use my own cocktail combinations of things. I don't take the stuff that's on the course, mostly because I never take the kinds of things that courses offer, like goo products in general. I don't use at all. Martin's, I don't use at all. And so those are the two most common ones you'll see at a race course. But in any event, point is, I have 2 10-ounce bottles. Remember when we were talking about Flip Belt a while back quite a bit? Yes, I use Flip Belt. 2 10-ounce bottles that I carry with me and throw off as I finish them. And they have a highly concentrated cocktail, and then I'm taking cups of water on the course, because if cups are more likely to spill and, like, get up your nose and all that kind of stuff, then water is better than anything else in that case. So I take the water cups regularly on the course, and I'm dumping them all over myself by accident. I'm terrible about drinking.
Or on purpose
cups
when it's warm.
Well, true.
It's a good idea.
But whether or not it's on purpose, it's happening. So the point is, that's better with water than other things. So I have my cocktail in my bottles, 20 ounces of liquid on my person while running. Doesn't slow a person down, especially if you're training with it and you're used to it. So, yes. Well, there you go. There you go, Sam. We've got a thorough response for any question. That's a good lesson here.
Next question is from Lorenda, and she writes, for my current cardio fitness level, my typical easy run is around 11:30 pace. This pace for me is conversational and one I feel like I could hold for a very long time. This past week, my mom wanted to join me on a run, so I slowed my easy run down even easier. She's 72 and hasn't run for almost a decade. Go, well, Lorenda's mom.
Props to mom.
Props to mom. Wow. And ended up with a 1.5 miles at 14:20 pace.
Nice.
Clearly that pace felt even easier for me because it was almost 3 minutes slower than my normal easy run. So then I got to thinking, when I'm running easy 11:30 pace, couldn't I always run easier? The answer seems to be yes, but what about an individual with an 8 minute easy pace run? Couldn't they run even easier too? Should they be running even easier? Basically, I have an easy run pace that could be between 11:30 and 16 minute mile before I'm fast walking, which is a big range. So my question is, Number one, is there a benefit to making you your already easy run easier? Or two, does the benefit remain the same within all those easy run paces?
Good thinking.
Yeah.
Good question. So we've got a couple layers of thoughts here for you, Lorenda, because there are, in fact, a number of considerations that shift with any kind of question. However, first, we have to say there's a lot of asking about pace here. We don't really talk about pace much here. I'm kind of kidding. But it's true. So we're talking about effort, and that's what you're saying as well. But we're not really going to address the question of pace as much as we're going to address the question of degrees of effort, because that's going to produce that result in pace. It would be much better if you ignored the pace altogether, didn't even know anything about it, and then tried to answer this question in terms of what exertion looks like here. So you have to frame every reflection on efforts around the intent of the training period. What is it that I'm trying to do with my training right now? And in knowing that, we can answer these types of questions. This is true for any kind of running efforts. So naturally, an easy run has multiple different potential uses and benefits depending on what I'm doing in that period of training. So for instance, musculoskeletal could be one where all it is I need to just put the load on my body. And in theory, in that instance, if that's my only goal, I could accomplish that at just about any pace. So just about any degree of effort, which then translates to you'll have situations like a good example is I was asking Barry McGee, my coach, about doubles. He was encouraging me to do some additional double runs during a period of time. And his point to me was they can be as slow as you want. They can be as easy as needed. Just trying to load up my body a little bit more. And then a friend of mine said, well, you should just go run with your kids then, knowing at the time that my kids might run a mile with me. You know, we're talking about maybe we could get up to 15 minutes worth of running. And he's like, just go run with them. That sounds like a great way to do a double run. He's like, sometimes I go into my backyard and I just run around with my kid. Well, and at the time, I think his son was a year and a half or so while he was saying this to me. And he's like, I just go run around with my kid while I'm like tossing a ball and he's just kind of crawling after it. And it's, you know, things like that, except for his kid was walking because his kid started walking at a super young age. Very impressive. Anyway, point is, there's definitely a time when it's not relevant, depending on what that run purpose is. And so if the argument is, this is what I'm doing here in my training, how easy should I run? Then I would suggest that there's a time, like when you're kind of building up, that you don't need to exert yourself at all. And so you should hold that effort as low as is reasonable in possibility. So you mentioned, Lorenda, you could theoretically go as slow as maybe 16 minutes per mile and still call it running before you're like fast walking. I would argue that there's somewhere probably before you get to 16 minutes per mile where you don't really feel like you're actually running anymore, but you're kind of just shuffling your feet in a running type of motion. I think that becomes too slow or too low of an effort. You want to maintain a running mechanic, a natural running mechanic. And however slowly you can do that, that's a good musculoskeletal stimulus and achieves that in that purpose during that time. However, here's the caveat. The assumption is the reason you're going that slow during that time is so that you can build up the load, the volume, more quickly, safely. So if I'm slowing down that much because I'm trying to run more and I want to make sure that I'm doing so healthily, then it makes sense to keep those runs as minimal of an effort as possible. So it may well be that you can run as minimal of an exertion as possible, but if you're not building up volume, you don't need to run that easy to achieve that goal. And so this is where the caveat is. I run as easy as I need to achieve that purpose, but it's not as much of a training stimulus when I'm exerting myself that little. So that's where I can gain more from the run if I don't need to run that easy within a degree of reason. So this is where, Lorenda, you say in the question, which is a good question to ask. Does the benefit remain the same? And the answer is no. There's different layers of benefit to an easy run, and an easy run is more beneficial ultimately, grand scheme of things, big picture, if it's at a higher effort, to a certain degree, because then you leave easy when your effort is too high. But all efforts have a range, and easy could be considered something like 50 to 70% of maximum effort, right? That's a large window. I'm talking about 20% worth of a window there. And so, and that doesn't include jogging, which is a kind of easy effort, which is 50% and below. So if I am looking for, okay, in this given period of time, when you're building up your, just your base foundation of total volume, running load, when you're doing that, it's better to keep the effort as low as possible so you can build things up faster, right? As long as it's safe and you're healthy. Once you have that load built up and it's now comfortable to sustain that, it's not like you're stretching yourself to get in the longer runs. Once you feel comfortable, then it's time to raise the efforts. It's time to elevate your efforts because you're able to now, and you will gain more from it at that point in time. You would not gain as much from it if you're trying to elevate the efforts before the total volumes are higher. So easy running then has, at a little bit higher effort, has greater value only if you are already structurally strong. So this is then in your situation here, for now, if you can increase those total volume, the total load, if you can increase how much you're running each week at the degree of effort you're giving right now, and it's comfortable, then you're good. You're fine. You don't need to slow it down substantially. Take every day as its own day. You know, you don't try to coerce a pace ever. Just give the amount of effort, and some days it'll be faster, some days it'll be slower, and that's all good. But then what it comes down to is once you're there in terms of total volume, you will be increasing the overall effort as well of easy running. Not a lot, and there's going to be an ebb and flow. For every runner, there should be the assumption that when I need to go easier, I will go easier no matter what the paces say, which is why we should just throw out the watch anyway. But that's kind of the layer and how you'll see those layers involved. Did I touch on everything?
Yeah, and just one more time, go Lorenda's mom.
There you go.
Love that. I love that she's back running that after a significant amount of time. That's great. We have another question from Daniel, and he had a running gait analysis, which identified some asymmetry. Left leg that strikes the ground further outside center line suggests he, and then there was a suggestion from his PT that he needed to overcorrect on the stride. Is that right?
I guess we think so. We don't know exactly where the suggestion came from because we're not exactly sure who conducted the gait analysis, but someone did, and we thought it was his PT because he was mentioning his PT as well. So as it goes, Daniel added some additional context because he sent us running footage to show us, here's how I'm running right now when I'm running naturally, and here's what it looks like when I'm trying to make this modification while running, based on this suggestion that he received, right, to correct his own stride. So we got to actually like watch the footage, which is awesome. Side note, he shared with us that in trying to implement this fix, over time he has noticed, this has been a while, he's been doing this for several weeks, over time he's noticed that his hips and his back have been getting tighter and sorer, more kind of progressing and worsening over time. And so that was the context for something, I want another opinion here. So thank you, first of all, Daniel, for sending along, and especially appreciate the footage because that allowed us then to be able to see what's happening. And here's what we notice when we watch the footage. First, definitely the observation that your legs are striking differently positionally is quite apparent. And we don't have the full gait analysis footage. We just have like footage taken outside while he's running by a camera, so to speak. I think it was someone's phone, but and so even there, which, you know, is less precise than like a full-on gait analysis camera setup, it's clear. So that's a good observation. His left leg is striking the ground a little bit to the side, and so you see a little bit of a kind of like a side hitch. But then also his left foot, as he's approaching ground strike, is rotated outward. Is that externally rotated? And so
supination.
No, not that way. Like ankle rotation.
Oh.
Yeah. And so when he's about to strike the ground, his left foot suddenly rotates inward. It almost kind of like snaps in. It's really interesting. And then he hits the ground in a somewhat natural. His foot strike actually looks fairly normal once it actually strikes the ground, but it's right before it strikes the ground where this motion happens. It's a very apparent thing. And so as we see that, we watch then a before and after. And so in the before, this is like him saying, this is how I'm just running when I'm not thinking about it. And what's clearly needs correcting. And then here's how I'm running when I am trying to correct it based on the suggestion that he received. And unfortunately, you can still see the asymmetry. So that effort to correct is not fully correcting it, which is almost always going to be the case in a situation like this. It's very hard to correct a running mechanic while we are running. We'll get to that in a moment. So that's where we then bring in some considerations here, some suggestions. So Andy, first of all, Andy's the form running queen, having studied under the form running king, I guess we would call you the princess then, wouldn't we?
Because you're kind of like that.
You're like his protege. We'll just call you the form running protege.
I'm a running nerd.
All right, so how do we correct any kind of running mechanic?
Well, it has to be autonomous or automatic.
Yep.
So doing the drills, the running drills before and after running, is the best way to do it. But also, in addition to the strengthening exercises a PT might recommend, those are also ways to do it. I do think that there are some cues you can give yourself while you're running. And I know that that's part of your conversation here, is like fixing it while you're running is not the place, but it is okay to be mindful and to try to think of things that are good cues. Because there's some things that aren't helpful that will make you tense in ways that you shouldn't be tensing, and actually overusing muscles because you're trying to drive at trying to use them, if that makes sense. So it has to be something that's a good form cue that allows for you to move in a proper way, not just trying harder.
Yeah, or trying differently. Yeah.
Or trying differently.
Right. Trying harder and trying differently are not necessarily good things.
For instance, there's I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but there was a really great running cue for me that helped me with my mechanics. That was a really simple thing. Like Dave Hodgkinson told me to get out of the weeds. So that meant like lifting my heels a little bit more. Well, think about that. That's helping you in a lot of ways. Like I was probably not having good knee lift, all of these other things that were going on, but that cue is a helpful cue no matter what. It's not changing something that you shouldn't be doing or like a drastic difference, but then it corrected me in a variety of ways, just that one cue.
But I will say it's not a helpful cue no matter what for everyone.
No.
And here's why. Because when Andy made that adjustment, when she consciously thought the thought that Hodge gave her to think and something changed, the result of that change was correct. In that instance, if someone says lift your heels and the person begins to try to make that change and the result is a bad running mechanic, then that's a bad cue, and that person needs to address, this goes back to Andy's first comment, it has to be autonomic function first. Your body needs to be able to move properly before while running cues will actually serve to benefit you long term. There are certain things you can do that just help you in terms of like energizing your running mechanic, which is kind of what Andy's describing. But ultimately, your body needs to be able to move properly. And it probably needs to be able to do that on its own without you having to consciously direct, because we just can't. Fundamentally, we can't consciously direct an incorrect motion into a correct motion unless our body already knows how, unless we've established that pattern neurologically, neuromuscularly. So this goes back to Jay DeSherry's work on the stuff. We've referenced his work for years now. The book that inspired it for us, and then we pursued learning more about what he's done with this stuff, is Running Rewired. And he writes extensively about the principle of wiring motion into our brain and doing that first as the most important element to be able to then address these other things.
I would say if there's like a significant thing that's not right in your mechanics, there probably is something else underlying, though, like some really crazy tightness that you have going on, or weakness, or compensation. There's probably something, and it's just going to be really hard to change that while you're running, because your body is going to be moving that way because of a dysfunction.
Yes, and so that's exactly right. So that's what Jay DeSherry then breaks down for us as the process to fix the problem. Whatever the problem is a three-step process, and it always must be for everyone. The first is mobilizing. We've got to be able to move properly. Not a question of like how to move properly, but can my body actually move in that way and do so easily? So we need to mobilize first and find out where are the immobility areas. I love how in the work DeSherry breaks down like there's different types of immobility, and depending on what is actually the kind of immobility I'm dealing with, I might have to address it in different ways, which is great. But then beyond that, so we've got to mobilize. That's step one. Step two then is we also have to strengthen functionally our body so that it can sustain the type of work we're doing. Now there's a big discrepancy in approaches on that concept. There's the old school thought of like just by running, you're going to strengthen what you need to do functionally, and that's the best way to do it. There's certainly truth to that, by the way. And so you don't want to discredit that thought. But as DeSherry notes, oftentimes running before I have strengthened certain things that need it causes poor wiring. And so like if you have a weakness somewhere, your body will compensate for that, and it may produce another problem you'll have to address down the road. And so what it comes down to is we should work to functionally strengthen our bodies, specifically in areas that we have asymmetrical weaknesses and clear impairments to our strength. So that's things like, you know, if I've got weak calves but overly strong quads, that may cause issues, you know, all that type of stuff. So functional strength in balanced approaches is good. And then once we've been able to address those two things, and maybe sometimes at the same time, but certainly we need to mobilize first and then we can do the rest. Step three is now we have to then address precision and coordination. And we do so in the types of activities, exercises, and drills that create a new autonomic function in our physiology, in our movement mechanics. And that's the key piece here, because if I am running, so Daniel, in your situation here, as noted, if I am running and I'm trying to correct a hip asymmetry, like in a foot strike, it's going to be almost, I don't want to say impossible because I'm sure someone could do it, but I don't think anyone could actually correct that while they're running, not in a successful long-term sense. So instead, that's a correction that happens through addressing symmetrical precision and coordination types of exercises. And these are the kinds of things that take a long time. So you're not doing this before you start training. You're kind of doing it while you're training, but you're spending a substantial amount of time here so that you can over time create an autonomic function that then happens while you're running by itself. With, this goes back to what Andy said, with the need for occasional prompts and cues to remind myself to get back into that correct rhythm. That's when those things become effective.
I like it.
All right. Love it. Good question, Daniel. All right, we got a final question here from Summer. We've got enough time. Do we have enough time? Let's do it anyway, even okay. If we don't. Because we like answering your questions as it goes. So this one I find to be compelling. We asked Summer specifically if we could share this question. It wasn't originally posted as like a share this question on the podcast. So Summer, thank you for being willing to let us share it, because this is the typical situation for runners. Like every one of us has probably experienced this in some sense at some moment.
Yeah.
And with the context that Summer shared, I think that it helps provide a very direct and precise response for everyone. That's our goal here, at least. All right. Go ahead, Andy.
I've been a social runner, but I'm finding it harder and harder to stick to my goals while hanging with the groups. So I'm navigating that, even if it means starting with everyone to help me get out the door and then doing my own thing once we start.
So that was the first point. And then we actually asked for more clarity, because Summer had shared, you know, it's harder to jive this balance? And we wanted to know more. What's actually happening that's difficult, and what are you trying to do about it? So Summer shared more.
The group I run with is generally faster than me, especially out of the gate. Their easy effort is my steady effort, and they start off much faster than I like to start.
Right,
I've always found it, if I start off really easy, I get stronger during my run. When I start off uncomfortably fast, like breathing too hard right away, I generally pay for it by being more tired throughout the run and for sure by the end.
That has a physiological explanation, yes, Summer. So that's not sure. Just you. Yeah. That's good. Yep. Yeah.
And it's just hard to see them, you know, pull ahead, she says, and that she wants to keep the big picture in mind and run slower as she's progressing so that she can build her aerobic fitness. So it's a battle, right, inside of each one of us between the social connection and then our goals and our plans and what we need to make the best adaptation. So she laments with us on that. So let's give our response.
Yeah, well, so thank you, Summer, for the context. Yeah. It's a tough situation, and we hear that. And for anyone listening who deals with that, these are not fun things to experience and easy things to experience, because it's like there's a relational component, and for most of us, the relationships are important. Like we're not trying to elevate our training above our people and our friends or something, and so it becomes a difficult moment for you. So we certainly appreciate anyone experiencing that and finding it challenging.
Yes.
So that being the case, you've also thought this through really well, Summer, and you have a very keen sense of the tension and the kind of the multiple layers involved in that. So we completely agree with your assessment of those layers, especially kind of the two basic competing forces here, which are: what do I need to get from my run, for my own training and the benefits therein? And how can I be social and engage with my running people at the same time? So we should note, this has been a challenge for runners since like the dawn of running. Are you going to personalize? Go ahead.
I can personalize.
You got it?
Do we like to personalize these things?
I mean, just...
I would like to share with Summer that I can relate to this.
Oh, you can.
I can. And one of the ways that I overcame in one situation, because there's always new ones that come up, but I ended up running my steady runs with a friend who ran faster than me. So her easy day was my steady day, and we were able to run together. Before we made that decision, before I asked for that, I was running way too hard. Like way too hard for my easy days and my long run days, because I wanted to hang, and I could, but I would suffer for it. And so, word of advice, just because you can hang doesn't mean you should hang.
True.
Because of course we have runs that serve a purpose to build our fitness for our peak goal. So that is one way. I also do sometimes have to put parameters on things and just communicate and tell my friends, like, I don't want to go any faster than this. Even though we don't like to talk in terms of paces, that's what people understand. So I can give myself a cushion by saying, I'm not going to run any faster than X. And is that okay?
That never works for Andy, by the way.
It has.
Never works.
It has worked.
You say so, but so
at least gets it in the ballpark of what it should be, rather than way outside the ballpark.
You're previewing our suggestions then. These are gonna, we're gonna layer in some of those thoughts. Appreciate that. Let me just quickly note that if it's been the case since, you know, the dawn of people offering their thoughts on challenges and running, I'm pretty sure this has been a part of it. You know, people have a hard time running together effectively. So yes, I think the first piece of advice that we would give, as Andy mentioned, like communication. So you should communicate to your running people about our podcast so that they can listen to us tell them what they should do to help you out. So you can do that, right? Right?
Right.
Okay, so Zach is kidding. Not. Yes. So the ideal here, in an ideal, because there is an ideal sense, and it's ultimately this: in an ideal world, we all know what we are all trying to accomplish and how best to accomplish that. So we understand how our training works and how we need to achieve those training goals. And then being all knowing like that, that we all are, we are sensitive to each other about how much effort someone should be giving in a given day and how much effort we're all giving as we're doing these things and what then we should be doing that day to serve as many people as we're able to, if not a couple different things happening to serve everyone. So that would be lovely. That won't ever happen. That ideal is not a reality in any situation we know of. So built into this then is kind of what can we do within this real situation? And so here we start with Lydiard's famous saying. I love this one. I share it often. He wrote at some point, this was like,
this is about a workout
in the 50s
though.
Or 60s. Not, no.
Was it about easy
running? This is just, he just says this about anyone running. He says, when I see a group of runners together, I think they're all running the wrong effort, but one. Because if any two people, this is the way that I paraphrase his saying, if any two people are running together, one of them, and most likely both of them, are running the wrong effort. Livingstone writes a fair bit about that as well when he writes about Lydiard's training approaches. Now, why is that? Because that is, in fact, a true statement. Why is that? It's for two reasons. One, because effort-based training means that I need to give exactly the amount of effort today that produces the desired result for my training. And you and I, not existing in a vacuum and not existing in an ideal situation at all times and all moments, unless we are literally like in exactly the same moment of fitness and everything else about our physiology that day happens to be identical. Unless that's true, there's no way that we're exactly exerting the same amount, producing the same result, and having it be correct for both of us.
Yeah, but there are also ranges of
I know, that are I'm getting to that. I'm getting to that. I'm being extreme on purpose because you have to set the baseline. Okay, so that is true. But at the same time, we don't have to be that extreme about it. None of us needs to be. We are not the Norwegian method where we're taking our blood sample after every interval to know if we're at exactly the right lactate threshold. Anyway, so if you've been hearing us, we've been talking a little bit about the double threshold training. We'll talk more about it as we go, but I find that to just be a little bit fascinating. Anyway, so what do we then do about this? Because we can't have the ideal, and the reality is not going to produce the desired results. So we find somewhere in between, and here are our suggestions. Andy shared a few thoughts there, but the first is there's got to be compromise. There has to be some amount of compromise because no one can have a group of runners all have exactly what they need that day perfectly. Since that's not possible, someone is giving in some sense. There's a couple different strategies that help that compromise be effective still for all of us, if possible. But the second layer that I will say personally is you can't change other people and shouldn't try. I should not tell other people this is what you need to do, whether it's for my sake or your sake. Shouldn't do it. Just creates tension, and the relationship piece is the reason we're doing this together. We don't need that tension, so I'm not going to do it. But you can tell them to listen to our podcast because then we can I'm kidding.
Well, you can articulate what you need and say, hey, this is what I'm doing today. Does that work with what you've got going on?
Yes.
This is what I'm going
to
do.
Now, this leads to Summer's challenge, which is, but what I'm doing today may not jive with what they're doing, and I may feel like it's more important to me to run with my people than to get the perfectly balanced amount of effort here at times. Like, or that's the pressure. You feel like I want to spend this time with these people, even if it's not what I should be doing training wise. So Andy's comment is there's times where it's, can I shuffle around my training a little bit? Like, I know I run with my people on this day. Do you happen to have a coach, Summer, who can adjust your training schedule and say, well, on that day, we could have it be a steady effort so that your friends who run whatever they're running produces for you what's more like a steady experience, we can get that done for you. There's another comment there though that's like, oh, I just like to start easier than other people, which by the way, that's me. I much prefer, this is actually, there's a lot of funny stories about this. I really like to start slow. Like I'll start running with Andy and she starts way too fast for me. And it's like, hey, can you slow down a bit here? We're like, we don't need to be sprinting yet. And she's like, we're not even running close to easy pace yet. I'm like, yeah, but it could be slower. So That's true for me. Every time I run with other people, I feel like you're going too fast. And oftentimes then they accuse me of like, I was the one pushing the pace. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense, because I was definitely barely keeping up. But this is how it goes. These are all the things. So in that case, Summer, you have a couple options there. Certainly one is trying to slow them up. You know, you can certainly say, can we start a little slower? But also, are you able to show up, you know, 5 or 10 minutes earlier and just jog first at an easier effort? And then kind of as people are ready to go, then you can start with them. Things like that, potentially. That doesn't always work, I understand. But depending on the timing. So can I rearrange the things that I'm doing in such a way that it fits better, that it jives better? Depending on the phase of training that isn't always available to us. And that's where Andy's comment again is, like, just communicating my needs. Oftentimes, if people knew, that might influence what they're doing. They might realize, oh yeah, I don't need to run any faster than whatever you want to do, and that's great for me today. Other times they may not, and they're jerks. And so I'm kidding. But I get it. And so there's some complications. We got to kind of navigate with that.
And there could be someone who's also needing to slow it down too, and you just gave them the opportunity and the place to also do what's right for their training as well. Because a lot of times the pressure is to push instead of the pressure to back off. And some people need the opposite. So just being able to be there and doing your thing the way you need to do it might actually be a good influence.
In fact, you could be the best influence on them by simply some gentle prompting. Yeah, no, it's not simple. These things are not easy and not straightforward, but we encourage you to pursue angles that allow for both, because we certainly understand and agree that
I love running with people.
Well, Andy does. Yeah,
I do.
I don't.
Much.
I don't
Sometimes
like.
You do.
I mean, I don't really like people.
That's not true, guys. He says these things. Just,
I got to run with one of our athletes the other day, and it was great. It doesn't happen as often as it ought to, and so I was glad for that. All right. Well, since we've answered all your questions now, and certainly have the opportunity to answer even more of them by you asking them at azrunning.com/question. For now, let's get on to the world of running. Let's start with some shout outs because we got to do it. So good. Chad, congrats on the second place finish at a 12-hour race. Chad's just gearing up for the big stuff and thought, yeah, why not go win some stuff? That was good. Very well done.
Congrats.
Mary, yes, congrats. Mary doubled up a 5K, 10K, and finished second age group in both.
Wow.
That's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Good work there. Trinity also did the double, 5K, 10K. Well done, Trinity. Lorenda and Alicia, who happened to be sisters, ran with the rest of their family in a 5K. So there's a whole big family thing, which just sounds like a blast.
I love it.
We got to see more of that. Good stuff.
Speaking of with family.
Yes, and Emily.
Yeah.
With family in a 10K pushed family members, being kids, in a double jogger.
So yeah.
Lots of good fun there. Jared was second overall in a 5K, and Michelle rode a 40-mile Grand Fondo because, you know, bikes are fun too, and we certainly talk about that as well.
Congrats, everyone.
Congrats on lots of great racing. A to Z runners are showing up and doing fun things.
Mm-hmm. For fun, some people like to run on the track, and the 2023 USATF NYC Grand Prix featured some headliner athletes, including Athang Mo. She hasn't raced in 11 months, so everyone was wondering, is Athang Mo going to, like, run at the U.S. Championship?
Is she going to run ever again? Like, or is she just going to walk the runway modeling now?
She could.
Do you remember Athang Mo, people listening? You should.
You should. You know,
but you might not, because we haven't talked about her in so long because she hasn't been doing anything.
So she hasn't raced in 11 months, as I said, but she ended up showing up for her opener in 158.73.
For the 800.
Winning by 2 seconds. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good opener, especially after not racing for so long. And she ran it in a conservative way. She ran it really...
As far as we can tell.
Yeah, she looked very in control, and then she dove in a little bit to her quicker gears in the end and ran really well.
to her credit, she always just looks in control and
that's true.
Smooth. So it's hard to know when she's actually having a hard time. She could have been like all the way down in the bottom of the well for that, and you wouldn't know.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
That's good. That's exciting. So for the USA, a Thingmo is like the, you know, the shining star in the 800 meters right now.
She's the American record holder, right?
Yes. And this is the problem. Since she hasn't been doing much, we haven't been spending a lot of time reviewing her accolades. But she's a defending medalist, and that's the key right there. When you have a gold medalist defending world champ, it's just really exciting, and you want to see them, you know, at the top of the game as long as possible because she's young as well. So,
yeah.
Good work there. Well, Andy tries to figure that out. A quick note here for the men's 800, also exciting.
So she does. She broke Ajay Wilson's 800 meter record. She ran 155.04.
Yes. Yep. And I do recall that. I just
Me too. But then you made me second guess myself.
Well, because then there's like Keely Hodgkinson just broke like a record, and so then.
But she's from Great Britain.
I know, but it starts to make me doubt. Have I been not thinking? So many records.
So many records.
All right.
Straight.
So Bryce Hopple won the men's race. He's looking good and strong, which is great because Bryce Hopple has been strong on the world scene for the U.S. in 800. But then Hobbs Kessler showed up. He ran a PR 800 meter. What did he finish? Third. Finished third, yep. And Hobbs Kessler is definitely, we're hoping, is like the next great threat in the mile scene. Recall that he has the high school 1500 meter record. Set that at 334, which is like way faster than the next fastest time. So that's huge. But then he just didn't do anything for a year, like tried, but not great success.
He acclimated to a new training group and professional
excuses
running.
Abound. The point is he wasn't successful for a while, and he would just as readily admit that as anyone else. But then he showed up and ran 332, which was a big, like a 2 second PR just recently. And now this 800 meter looked strong. So we're thinking, okay, Hobbs Kessler looks like he's in a groove now. That would be great because once he starts grooving, I think good things will happen.
And he'll likely do the 1500 meter run.
He's not going to do the 8. His 800 time is, I mean, there was a PR, but it's not fast enough to be like world class. His 1500 is.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was more track at Stumptown Twilight. Just a couple notes, not much. You can actually watch it, and we did. I've embedded it at AtoZRunning.com. But I'm going to just note a couple things. Sinclair Johnson ran her second fastest time ever in the 1500-meter run in 4:00.77. And she just opened her season last weekend at Hayward Field. So
late start.
It's a late start, but she's
looking
really good.
Defending U.S. champ.
Yep, defending U.S. champ.
Definitely a good pick for making the world team.
Well, we got Corey McGee, too.
Oh, yeah.
What's Josette Norris going to do?
We'll see, yeah. Point is, I think it makes sense that Sinclair Johnson opened up late this season because if she's really just focused on the big stuff late summer, she doesn't want to be running too many things too fast too early. There's certainly a conversation about the momentum that's valuable to runners, but she'll be able to build that up.
Well, it looks like she's in great form running her second fastest time. Safwan Hassan always runs fast no matter what she's doing, it seems.
Yeah,
because she also was at the Stumptown Twilight, which was kind of bizarre. It seemed a little outside the norm.
So my guess is there were a lot of runners there that's like, why are they there and why are they running that event? And I think they were all Nike runners, and this is a Nike event. So I think that it just comes down to contractually, they probably are honoring a request from the sponsor in some of these situations.
She time trialed it.
Just solo. There were only four women in the race.
Only four women in the race, and of course, Safwan Hassan is one of the best in the world. So she was running and lapping.
And lapping.
She ran a solo time of 14:55, and really just looked like she was grooving.
I mean, at that pace for Safwan Hassan, that's probably not too big a reach. You know, like she probably was working reasonably hard, and that's about it.
And she didn't look like it.
Yeah. She's slated for another marathon majors. Which one is it?
Chicago.
Is that it?
Chicago is going to be crazy.
Yeah, cool.
It's exciting. Yeah. Western States 100 was the highlight of this past week, though.
Well,
that's
sure.
What I'm going to say.
I mean, Western States is exciting.
Absolutely bonkers the performance that Courtney DeWalter accomplished at this event. So Western States 100 is the world's oldest 100-mile race. There's 1,800 feet of elevation gain and 22,000 feet of loss. So very
So you just climb
volatile.
A mountain and then go back down it. Is that it?
You'd have to ask Courtney. I sure haven't done
Except
it,
to do 100 miles, you have to maybe spiral up the mountain.
Anyway, I left you hanging for too long. Courtney DeWalter smashed the record there at Western States 100 by 78 minutes.
We're talking an hour and 18 minutes better than anyone's ever done it before.
Insane.
Now, one caveat, because for ultras especially, the conditions on the day or days, this one's a day because she did it in 15 hours and change. Yep. So the conditions on the day make a huge difference. So if you have good conditions, you're going to see abnormally fast times, but not like this.
Not like 78
like
minutes.
The person in second place, that would be something. She broke the previous course record by 4 minutes.
She did.
That means that Courtney DeWalter won the race by an hour and 14 minutes.
Yes. Yep. And second place was Katie Scheid. And like Zach said, she also broke the previous record. And to give you even more perspective on this, Esther Seileg was third in a time of 17:09, a time that would have won the women's title at every other Western States 100 except for 2012. So the top three were faster
and she's
than
an
most
hour
years.
And 40 minutes slower than first place.
Insanity.
That's what's just so crazy here. So, I mean, the conversation is clearly first, Courtney DeWalter has already been an obvious, she's next level ultramarathoner. And some of the things she's done have proven that in various ways. This is just a definitive, nobody's ever done that.
And thank you to Brandon for sending this my way, because even though it's such a big accomplishment, sometimes the running news sources don't always publish about these things. So I was really happy to make sure that we covered it. So if you ever see really big running news and you're like, Andy, you got to cover this stuff, please send it our way. We love to try to get things like the ultra stuff doesn't seem as well represented in some of the forums and things as track running, for instance. So please send it our way. And it should be. Yeah. People are, it's like the most incredible feat.
I mean, it's really something. So we got a couple bonuses here for you because there's just so many exciting things. First is the BAA 10K. BAA, that's Boston Athletic Association. They do a 10K. It's one of the bigger road 10Ks in the world each year. And so you get top-level international talent. It's always exciting to see who's going to show up and who's going to do it. Well, Helen O'Beery is on just this crazy road streak right now. She's she's going to just beat almost everybody at everything. And so she won again.
She did.
Another race. Another victory.
It was hot and humid conditions and wasn't great, but Helen O'Beery went out really fast and she did end up slowing.
She paid for it.
She did pay for it.
Just not as much.
Yeah, she talked through, very humbly talked through, that she was struggling in the race. She ended up only winning by 4 seconds, but she had gapped the field at just over a mile early on. So then she was chased down, but still held on to her victory. 2 second, Stacy Nidwin, and she was only, like I said, 4 seconds behind Helen O'Beery. And then Emily Sisson was the first American in fourth place. And she had originally thought that maybe she would go for the American road record in the 10K. But
yeah, if it's not hot and humid.
Yeah, but she threw that one out that goal kind of out after she found out what the weather forecast was going to be. And she just wanted to run a strong finish. And she wanted a podium, almost got her goal with fourth place.
Yeah, I mean, so we're talking about these aren't crazy fast times because of the conditions, but lots of exciting racing nonetheless. It's good stuff. Gabriel Gie of, I believe, Ethiopia won the men's race, and Diego Estrada was the first American in fifth place, I think. We don't have it listed here, but he was in fifth place.
And to know who Estrada is, he's a two-time U.S. champion. 2014, he was the champion in the 5K, and in 2015, he was the half marathon champion.
Right on. Last one here, and this is always just a fun thing to cover. The Ethiopian 10,000-meter trials has become something of a, like a sensation. And so it's a lot of fun to...
Because they're so good.
Well, so by itself, this race tends to be the fastest 10,000-meter of the year. With rare exceptions, the World Champs or Olympics will be faster. But even then, not usually. Those tend to be more competitive, but not by much. So
this is championship-style racing.
Well, yeah, and here's what goes down. The Ethiopians have been, in the distance racing scene, just incredibly dominant for two reasons. They're fast up front. They've got some of the fastest times ever. But also, they're very deep. There are a lot of potential runners who will show up big. And so you just kind of never know exactly who's going to do it. And that's why it's a lot of fun to watch this. For instance, in the men's race, the top two were predictable. These two certainly have been on the scene. Mm-hmm. Olympic champion Salomon Berega. So you know he knows how to get it done. Set himself up for a perfect victory on the shoulder of Diamond League 5,000-meter champion Berihu Aragawi. And Aragawi leading with 100 to go, but Berega's on his shoulder. Berega's known for his good kick, but he couldn't quite do it. And that's not because he didn't try. Aragawi just had it today, or this day. So Aragawi takes the victory over the Olympic champ, which is something, 26:50 to 26:51, which are the two fastest 10,000-meter times run this year by anyone in the world. So this is what I mean by, like, just to win the Ethiopian trials, you have to be the best in the world to do this. So they did it, and they were fast, and that's exciting. But on the women's side, well, hang on, in third place.
Yeah, third place.
That's why I said, yeah.
This is a U20 person.
Well, that's why I mentioned that anyone, you never know what's going to happen here, because this guy, 17 years old, Yisma Dailu, finished third in 27:08, which is the second fastest ever U18 time. So we're talking under 18 years of age. For example here, the United States record for U18, which is not exactly U18 because it might have been someone who was 18. Can't remember exactly how old he was when he did it. This was in the 1970s. Anyway, it's like 28:30. So he's running at the level of the best American runners historically, and he's 17 years old. That's just crazy.
And was third? Was he third?
He was third, yep.
Oh, my word.
So may or may not, with the way this goes, by the way, for the Ethiopian trials, it doesn't necessarily matter how you finish in terms of guaranteeing that you make the team. Certainly the one who wins is going to be selected, but beyond that, they use discretionary seats. They don't necessarily take people that, there are some instances in many years where it's like, why did they not take that person and took someone else? And so it's not always straightforward, but good chance that the 17-year-old might end up on the the Ethiopian team.
Yeah.
And then in the women's race, it just continued.
Yeah, the women's 5,000 champ, Gudaf Sege, dominated the run, running the fourth fastest time ever of 29:29 in the 10,000.
Crazy,
so fast. But Gudaf Sege, you'd expect that she would be the champion.
Yeah, I mean, race. World champ in the 5,000 last year, also broke the world record indoors in the mile or 1500. I can't remember which distance it was, but some years ago. So like, she's one that, you know, is always likely to be there. But when she goes that fast,
and then the next two are both under 30 minutes. So like Zach said, the depth is incredible. Ajehu Tai and Lemlem Hailu in 29:57 and 29:59 respectively.
Yeah. And even that fourth place was only 2 seconds after that in 30:01. So it's like, you know, what does it take to, again, to just be in the top three in the Ethiopian trials? Well, you got to be the best three 10,000-meter runners in the world practically. Notably, who are we missing here, Andy? Who wasn't running it?
Sifan Hassan.
No, she's not Ethiopian.
She's not. I know that. I'm sorry. She's from the Netherlands.
Letessen Bagide was not in the race because she doesn't have to be. Because she's a guaranteed entry because she's defending world champion.
You all, I'm too tired. So, I do know these things.
Okay. So, yes, Letesan Bagide is Ethiopian. She's the world record holder in the 10,000. She's also the defending world champion in the 10,000. She does not have to run in the Ethiopian trials because as the defending world champ, she has a guaranteed entry.
And that means that Ethiopia also has an extra spot.
Yes. So the world champ doesn't count against a team's allotment as well for an event. This is always fascinating stuff. So Ethiopia can send four women in the 10,000 if Gide runs it. Similarly, Gudaf Sige is the defending 5,000 world champ, so Ethiopia can send four women in the 5,000 as well if Sige runs it. So Sige and Gide could run the 5,000, 10,000 double, both of them, and neither of them count against Ethiopia's allotment. So you're cool. Almost guaranteed they're going to do that.
Right.
Which is really kind of fascinating to see. What's going to happen? It's so exciting.
We love track.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of excitement coming. U.S. championships are only a couple weeks away, so you'll hear some coverage on that here soon. And then Diamond League's got some more going on, and the World Champs are coming down the pike. So we'll be setting you up so you know what's going to happen and can anticipate that with great enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Lots of enthusiasm here at the A to Z Running Podcast. Thanks for sharing it with us. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.